Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and pleased to have back birding expert Bill Volkert. He's a retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist. He's worked at the Horican Marsh for 27 years, and he's been watching birds for well over 40 years. So, as we visit with him, what questions do you have about attracting birds to your yard, perhaps? Where do you observe birds in the wintertime? I hope you'll join in the conversation. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Send your photos or your questions to ideas@wpr.org. Our phone lines are down right now, so and we're not sure we'll have them back before the show's over. So, hey, send us an email, ideas@wpr.org. And again, if you have a photo, a bird photo, maybe an ID, or maybe just a nice photo, I hope you will send that along, and Bill and I will both have a chance to see it. And Bill Volkert, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Well, thank you, Larry. Always nice to be with you and share a little time to talk about birds.
Yeah, for sure. We don't have a lot of different species of birds right now, but they're easier to find in Wisconsin. Talk about that a little bit.
Oh, sure. Well, winter's, of course, a time of scarcity in a lot of ways. So the vast majority of our birds back in late summer and fall already started heading south. And they're going down to where not only the weather's nice, but there are food resources for them. But we do have a nice mix of birds in wintertime. Some that remain year-round are common birds like chickadees, blue jays, cardinals. Those are pretty well year-round residents. And then we'll get some migrants coming in from the north, birds we don't see other times of the year, such as the rough-legged hawk, which nests in the Arctic, along with what I consider its counterpart, the snowy owl. And also, this is a pretty good year for the finches. And we refer to this as occasionally a finch eruption. What happens is these birds are not normal north-south migrants. In fact, as cold as Wisconsin can be in wintertime, some of these birds will remain in Canada during the harshest winter imaginable as long as they have food. But they're all specialists on different kinds of cone crops. And so when there's poor production of either a variety of spruces or pines, the different birds that favor those are forced to fly south. And this is one of those years. So there's been some pretty good reports of a variety of the winter finches. It was already back late summer, very early fall, that we saw pine siskins moving south in big, big numbers. Some of those are still remaining in Wisconsin. It appears that some of them continued heading south and are actually beyond Wisconsin for the vast majority. We now also are seeing evening grosbeaks showing up in quite a bit of the state, especially that northern half of Wisconsin, a bird that really hasn't been seen in good numbers in Wisconsin in a number of years. The pine grosbeak, another bird that's somewhat uncommon, they're showing up, and also the crossbills, white wing and red crossbills, are making a show of themselves, along with red poles. So these are birds that are considered this eruptive finch. As I say, it's every so often food crashes up north and they're forced to move either east-west or to the south to look for some other food sources, and they're in Wisconsin now.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Jeff emailed that he's interested in improving the habitat for birds at his farm, and it's near Black River Falls. His soil's generally sandy, supports a corn-soybean rotation. Any suggestions? Mm-hmm. He was considering adding high bush cranberry bushes.
High bush cranberry is not a very sought after food for birds. In fact, you'll see the berries hanging on in wintertime, and it seems that they're extremely tart and not that desirable. Also, you've got to be a little careful because the most available one in a lot of nurseries is a European high bush. And it's a bush that can be somewhat aggressive. I wouldn't say it's highly invasive, not like buckthorn, but I like to encourage people to stick with native varieties. What I would suggest, if you're looking for something that has some good berry crops, consider the dogwoods. Gray dogwood forms a nice thicket. It's not normally used heavily for nesting, but the berries are very abundant at the end of summer. And the birds really hit that on their way out, especially robins and other thrushes. Silky Dog was another one that is a pretty good shelter, can grow into quite a thicket, and produces a good crop. Sumacs are not a real heavily sought after food source for most birds. You will see chickadees picking at it, but it makes a nice edge species. Elderberries, another one that could possibly be grown. So those are all good ones that grow along the edge of a forest or in hedgerows.
Yeah, those are really good suggestions. Jeff, thank you so much for that email. I appreciate it very much. A listener emailed, they have every kind of woodpecker at their feeder except a pileated woodpecker. They live in the country, and they just bought a new suet feeder with a long extended board, specifically for a larger bird. What can they do to attract them?
Well, I guess the best you can do is cross your fingers. They're a bird that really favors the large tracts of forest and also large trees. Being a big woodpecker, they need a not only a pretty big forest track, but they tend to go after the insects that are really at the center of rotting trees, especially the ant galleries, so carpenter ants. And normally the trees are already dying and being infected. They'll just excavate the food source. Now, the pileated, or also pronounced pileated, both, by the way, are acceptable. This is a bird that seems to be increasing in Wisconsin and becoming a little bit more widespread. And probably the biggest reason for that is just the maturity of our forests. A lot of our forest stands are getting older, so we have got bigger trees. And the birds seem to be showing up in more places around Wisconsin and in somewhat bigger numbers. But again, they're never really dense. The best you'll ever see is maybe a pair, or if you're lucky during the nesting season, a family before they disperse.
Tyler has, I think, the sound, and then we'll get back to you, Bill, here. Listen.
Please.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, now the call of the pileated woodpecker is somewhat reminiscent of the flicker, a smaller, somewhat close relative, another woodpecker. But it's much more robust. It's much louder, a heavier, deeper cackle to it. The rhythm, especially from a distance, can sometimes be a little confusing. But up close, nothing sounds like the pileated. The other thing I was going to say is there is a chance in some woodlots, when they are dispersing, they may show up. So in other words, the adults will hang on to their territory, and in a mid-late summer and sometimes in spring again, others, younger, moving around looking for places, and they may show up here and there. And I've seen them in actually fairly small woodlots, but they don't stick around usually.
Yeah. Well, Jay in Madison emailed that years ago there was a photo taken of a blue downy woodpecker, a blue one. Was that a legit variation or was that a spoof? Do you remember that?
Spoof. Yeah. Blue is not really a true pigment. It's reflected light. And so it's the structure of the feathers. Now, what may be out there is the black of the little downy woodpecker, perhaps in certain lighting, or I guess tweaking it on a computer, you could get a little bit of a blue cast to it. But no, they're not going to produce anything with blue.
Nope. Okay. You can join in, too, with your emails at ideas@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Phones are down, so go ahead and email us. Vern in Harvard, Illinois, emailed that he and his wife were walking in a wooded area of a park in northern Illinois on Monday, and they saw a small mixed species flock of sparrow-like birds. They were too far away and moving too quickly to get a clear idea of the birds. They would occasionally see a flash of blue, similar to the blue of indigo buntings or bluebirds. He doesn't think those species are still around here, and the birds definitely weren't blue jays.
Okay. Bluebird is occasionally a winter bird. Yeah, bluebirds actually can be a winter bird in Wisconsin. They're a member of the thrush family, so they're somewhat closely related to our robins. And believe it or not, on the Christmas bird counts that we conduct across Wisconsin during this time of year, in many years, robins and even bluebirds will be sighted in some locations. So there's always a few that might linger. And surprisingly, some of them can make it through some pretty severe weather, a cold snap or two. So yeah, bluebird is not a bird I would expect in wintertime, but it's always a good find, and it's not entirely out of the question.
Yeah, absolutely. Jim emailed that he saw a red-breasted nuthatch at the feeder yesterday, very active and considerably smaller than the white-breasted nuthatch. That was a first for Jim. Are they common around here? He's in southeast Wisconsin.
Okay, yeah, good question. I like red-breasted nuthatches. They're cute little birds. The white-breasted, of course, is a little bit more common and widespread. We had a very good movement of red-breasted nuthatches in the late part of summer, and some of them will stick around throughout the wintertime. And as mentioned here, suet seems to be a pretty good bait for them to bring them into a bird feeder. Now, the difference between the two nuthatches is that white-breasted nuthatch is typical mostly of the deciduous forest, our broadleaf forest, where red-breasted nuthatch, they prefer the conifers. So for our Christmas bird counts, I'm in the northern Kettle Moraine. I usually look for a few pine and spruce plantations, and I'll search those out to try to add a red-breasted nuthatch or two to the count. But not unusual, as I'm wandering around, for them to come into more open areas and backyards to seek out a bird feeder.
And, let's see, as long as we're on our emails here, John emailed that he just built an owl birdhouse. He's wondering how high to mount it. And is direction important, you know, north, south, east, or west? Also, what's a good time to get it in use? Is there any worry about other birds taking it over?
Well, the boxes that we use for owls, and these are usually the little screech owls, it's about the same dimensions as a wood duck box. And in fact, I have on several occasions found screech owls roosting in wood duck boxes. So, yeah, if you put it out there, you never know what you're going to get. Maybe a wood duck, maybe even a squirrel take shelter in there. You can erect it anywhere from, say, about 5 to 20 feet up. They may occasionally nest there, but I think more often it's a roost site for them, a place to get out of the weather during the day and the shelter. And I usually don't see them in there. I've got a few experiences of actually seeing one on a sunny day poking his head out of a wood duck box or out of a natural cavity. But I have that when I'm cleaning out my wood duck boxes, actually found the little pellets in there. So owls will swallow their prey whole. So they'll take a whole mouse and choke that right down. And since the bones are too hard to digest, they'll actually keep that in the stomach. It'll get compacted with the undigestible hair, and then they'll basically cough that up and you'll find the pellets.
There you go.
There's evidence of the bird without actually seeing it in there.
Bill Volkert, our guest today, taking a look at bird watching in wintertime, and certainly looking forward to your emails as we move along today. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. No phones at the moment, so send your emails. And if you have photos, send them as well. We'd certainly love to see them. Jill Nadeau, our producer, Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator and naturalist, worked at Horick and Marsh for 27 years. And he's been watching birds for a lot longer than that. He has over 3,900 species that he has sighted. So it's great to have him back. Certainly, if you want to join in again, our emails are working fine. So email us at ideas@wpr.org. And you can send a photo as well. If you've got a bird photo you want to show us, that'd be great. You know, here's an interesting question. Another listener emailed to ask, how did the red-bellied woodpecker get its name? It doesn't have a red breast. But has a red nape of neck and on back of the head. Why not name it a red-necked woodpecker?
Well, I would agree with that. The male has the red going from the very front of the forehead, all the way across the top of the head, where the female has a little spot right above the bill, and then that red nape, the back part of the head down through the neck. Yeah, red-bellied is not a really good name, and we usually don't see that because woodpeckers cling to the side of trees, so the belly is always pressed against the tree bark. A lot of these birds were named very early on, and between some of the early ornithologists, including John James Audubon and Alexander Wilson, they were collectors. Optics weren't that good at the time and barely available, and so it wasn't unusual for people to shoot birds, mount them, and of course, that's also what we see as museum specimens. They were laid on their back, and this is how they're preserved, in drawers and shelves. If it's laying on its back, you'll see the pinkish color of its belly. It'll stand out like that in a museum skin. But yeah, out in the wild, it is a really poor field mark. It's something that you don't normally see. And yeah, it isn't the best name for that bird, at least as far as we tend to see it or recognize it.
I wish it had a different name too. Tyler's got the sound of the red belly. Cool sound.
That is one of several vocalizations. They also do a very common little chuck, 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 with a little contact call between the birds. They tend to be one of the more vocal of our woodpeckers, where woodpeckers really don't normally have a real diverse vocal repertoire. They haven't got a big vocabulary. They make some pretty simple sounds. The red belly is kind of the exception. He's tends to be a little bit noisier than the rest, and also produces a pretty good variety of vocalizations. And it's a bird that has been moving north of Wisconsin, is now found in most counties in Wisconsin, except the very far northeast in the heavy woods there, Forest Florence County. Probably pretty sparse there.
Yeah, probably. Phil messaged us that he always had lots of finches all year long, both yellow and purple. As of last winter, they just disappeared. 2 years ago, he had to fill the thistle feeder every week. Now he's lucky if they empty it in 3 months. He lives just north of Madison.
Well, this is what I mentioned earlier about the eruptive finches. They come and go. It's not very predictable. Interestingly, there is an annual report that comes out of Canada, and these are the ornithologists and foresters that look at the cone production and tend to predict which birds may be moving south because of the failure of the cone production for that particular year. And as I say, this year is a little better finch year, and we'll see what shows up at feeders. People are seeing a fair number of the pine siskins still in Wisconsin. The purple finch came down very early in some good numbers. And as I mentioned, some of the other stragglers here, especially the pine grosbeak and evening grosbeak, are always possibilities, as well as the red pole. Thistle seed or Niger seed is a good one, and then the black oil sunflower seeds for some of the larger finches. And being nomads, it's hit and miss. I think also for southern part of Wisconsin, we haven't had a very good snow cover. And so there's a lot of available food. It's very accessible, but we get a little bit of dousing of snow. And I know northern Wisconsin is getting it. That oftentimes forces the birds into the feeder where food is easier to get, too.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Gary emailed. He saw a huge eagle, probably 8-foot wingspan, with a dark head in Eastman, Wisconsin, in the Driftless area. He wonders if it could have been a golden eagle.
Could have been. It tends to be in that western part of Wisconsin, where the golden eagles come down for the winter time. The problem is that whether it's bald eagle or golden eagle, they go through a number of years of plumage change. So bald eagle will not attain a white head and tail till it's about 4 or 5 years old. And between the first, second, third year plumages, there's variation. And unless you're really looking close or somewhat experienced, they can be difficult to sort out. Wisconsin started a golden eagle survey once we realized that they seem to be showing up a little bit more regularly in that part of the state. And so they're getting people together, but there is a little crash course to make sure that we've got reliable information. People go through a review of the differences of the different ages and plumages of both bald eagle and golden eagle. And then they go out and search the area to see what they can find. So yeah, he's in the right location for it, but, and it's not an out of the ordinary that to maybe find a golden eagle, but it is a little difficult to sort them out sometimes.
Yeah, it is indeed. Tim Isley emailed a great photo of a pileated woodpecker. It was the highlight of his deer season.
Seeing it here, and
photographing it.
Great.
Tim knows how to take a good photo. He's got that in very sharp relief there of that pileated woodpecker. It's great to see. Thank you for sending that,
Tim. And I've got something to do while you're sitting in a tree stand, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Oh, man. Marilyn emailed that she, as she drives down country roads in winter, flocks of snow buntings and larks, she believes they're larks, flies up from the side of the road on the bleakest, windiest days. Where do they find shelter?
These are birds of open country, and they are the horned lark will either be, there's a few subspecies. They're either nesting out in the prairies. There's also an Asian subspecies out in the grasslands of Mongolia and another subspecies into the Arctic. So they like big open sweeps without trees. The snow bunting and Lapland longspurs also are birds that nest in the Canadian Arctic. So when they come south, they're looking for these big open areas. As far as shelter, I think just a little mound of snow, a little hump out of the, you know, when you're only about 4 or 5 inches tall too, it's pretty easy to shelter yourself. And they'll hunker down a little bit out there. But they're looking for food in the open. And believe it or not, one of the best places to look for is if you've got snow cover and freshly spread manure. There's a lot of undigested feed that runs through the cows, and it is a food source for them. When you don't have snow cover, these birds are really hard to find because they can be out in, say, a 100-acre cornfield with the stubble and humps of dirt. Yeah. And you're trying to find a brown bird out there. You got to wait for them to get up and fly. So these are birds during Christmas bird calls. We drive the roadsides. We look over the open fields. If you also get a good snow cover, they're sometimes forced right to the edge of the roads, especially where the plows kind of open up along the shoulder, because they also, in order to digest and crush up those seeds, they need a little bit of grit. So they'll pick up some of the gravel there since they don't have teeth. And we'll sometimes see them along roadsides or these big open fields. You've got to have a quick eye because you're going to see them just jump up and fly off. The snow bunting stands out well because it's black and white. But Lapland longspurs and the horned lark can sometimes at a distance be a little hard to sort out unless you've had some experience with them. But those are birds to watch for, especially if people are just driving country roads.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's go to Marilyn's email. She emails that she drives down the country roads in the winter. Wait a minute. I already had her up. I'm sorry. John emailed. They have some property in Vilas County, and for many years they've had some gray jays, Canada jays, show up during the fall and winter. This is in Vilas County. They were a friendly bird that would gladly eat suet along with a variety of people food. Over the last 3 or 4 years, these birds have not returned, and they've not observed them anywhere else in this portion of the North Woods. Is climate change contributing to this disappearance? The gray jays, Canada jays.
Perhaps. It's been named Canada Jay because that's pretty appropriate. They love those spruce forests across most of Canada. They're also found in parts of the Rocky Mountains. In Wisconsin, we're just south of the actual range for these birds. There are a few little islands of them, and you've got to find the spruce swamps in northern Wisconsin. And so they're sort of punctuated. There's a few little areas where we find the gray jay this far south, and another bird that will associate with it occasionally is the boreal chickadee. It's got a brown head rather than black. And there's just a few little places where we might find those holding in that far northern tier of Wisconsin. In the lowland bogs usually is where I search for them with black spruce. Seems that the boreal chickadee has been declining in Wisconsin. Perhaps this is climate change. But here again, we have a very small population that's kind of isolated. So who knows if there's other disturbances or developments or something that's putting pressure on those birds. It's, I think, a little inconclusive yet. But it's a tough one to find because, as I say, a little flock here and there across so much of the northern part of the state, but always a great bird.
Kathy emailed, here's an interesting one. She emailed that a coworker found a bluebird house full of mushrooms. Wondered how common that was. And I'm assuming, wow. I'm assuming that they didn't grow inside, or maybe they did. I can't tell if they grew inside or some bird or some animal put them in there.
Well, if they're growing in there, then you've got a real problem with moisture and something. I would doubt, the bluebird houses are up too high and too dry for that. I'm guessing that something was harvested and brought in there. And I would think that probably, I've actually had a lot of deer mice in bluebird boxes. You sometimes see them hunkering down in there, or other little rodents. So that's my guess, is you have a rodent that's making a harvest of those and a cache, a food cache. So they're storing them up like a little, using like a silo, I guess you could say.
Oh, man. Well, thanks for sending that, Kathy. I've never heard that one before. Pete in McQuantigo emailed that last spring he saw a gorgeous bird. He finally identified it as a Western tanager, but once he looked it up, he thought he must have made a mistake because they're not usually this far east. But it definitely was, and wishes he could have taken a picture. Also, is it okay to feed birds roasted peanuts, either shelled or unshelled? His concern is they might take on water while being, I'm not quite sure, cached. Also, what's the status of the northern goshawk in Wisconsin? So a few questions here. Is it
okay? I'll try to remember all of them here. As far as peanuts, if you put them in a feeder, they tend to stay fairly dry. But anybody who has their bird feeders out during the wintertime, it's always a good idea to periodically, when you find that they're getting low or empty, take them inside, rinse them, use some warm water and bleach, and then rinse them again with warm water just to disinfect them and get them back out. But I would think that if you have your peanuts, just like any other food source out there, just so they're not sitting out and getting totally soaked, shouldn't be a problem. My only concern would be is to make sure they're not salted.
Yeah.
As far as the goshawk is concerned, this is a bird of the North Woods. It is a bird that requires a fairly big territory. They also have been declining somewhat in Wisconsin. It's always a spectacular bird to see. It's the largest of our occipiter hawks, a relative of that Sharpshin and Cooper's. Not sure exactly what the problem is, why we're seeing a little bit less production of the goshawk, but in wintertime, they may visit anywhere in the state, and nesting is primarily that northern third of Wisconsin. And Pete, the first part of his question was?
It had to do with a Western tanager. Would it have gotten this far east?
Yeah, now if you look in your field guide, it'll show it's appropriately named. It's a Western bird. So it's a counterpart of our scarlet tanager in the eastern United States. But there are reports of this bird occasionally showing up in Wisconsin. It's certainly not a regular visitor, but we do get these wanderers. And I think for the bird watchers, it always makes it exciting is not only to watch the regular seasonal occurrence of birds, but these oddballs that get way off course. And speaking of that, we right now have an Allen's hummingbird in Wisconsin, a bird that for most of its life is right along the coastal part of California. How that hummingbird got here and why, who knows? And so I think today, especially since we have a lot of people out there who enjoy birds, who watch birds and report their sightings, we're starting to get a little bit more of these unusual sightings and realizing that not all these birds are always true to habit and that some of them will wander tremendous distances, whether they get swept up in a weather system and a wind or who knows what is driving them. I don't know if we can always come up with the same cause and effect of why they would go this far out of their normal range. But it's curious that, some of these will show up in the strangest places.
I hope that Allen's Hummingbird gets the heck out of Wisconsin before too long. We got a really big cold spell coming our way here in a day or two, so it's going to be a cold
Christmas.
Yeah,
but here's an odd thing about hummingbirds. I remember back in the early mid-80s, there were some of the early reports of a hummingbird being sighted in Wisconsin in November and even the first week of December. And on one or two occasions, bird watchers were so concerned about the fate of these birds, they actually made arrangements with airlines to fly them down toward Florida. Well, it's not easy to do, to snatch him up and, you know, give him enough food, hold him over and give him a first-class ticket and get him down there and release him in the wild and hope he finds his way around. What we found, though, is that, as again, people have been watching birds across so much of the U.S., there are occasionally a few individual hummingbirds of different species that will hang around what is to us way too late in the year. And it seems that they are able to survive those weather and cold snaps. We've had this on occasion. More common is not so much our ruby-throat hummingbird, which is our regular one, but western visitors such as the rufous hummingbird. They can hang out awful late in the year, which just is mind-boggling for us how long they stick around. The question is, why is it that they fail to migrate or get so far off course in the first place? And then we see them coming to a feeder and then they just disappear. Did they really get up enough energy and finally get the signal and head south and survive? Did they freeze off of their perch? We don't know the fate. So that's always a little guesswork. But these sightings, some of these can be extremely late. And it does seem that some of these birds are able to survive that and then head out way beyond what we would expect.
Matt in Wausau emailed to ask if the snowy owls are going to show up in numbers this year. He was fortunate enough to work with as a DNR LTE in Horican Marsh in the early 90s. And he met you, Bill. As a matter of fact, it was Matt in Wausau. Just a quick thanks to you for your willingness to share what you know about birds and the environment. You made a lasting impression on him that still continues today with this radio show.
Oh, well, that's really nice to hear. I appreciate the compliments and nice to hear from him. This is not a huge year for snowy owls. There have been about 50 or so sightings in Wisconsin, so it's not a real bad year. It's not a major invasion year or eruption year of them either. They seem to be showing up in fair good numbers along the Lake Michigan shore. They'll be hunting for ducks out there and whatever else they can find. I just saw a report, the Oconto count, they've been reporting them quite regularly for a bunch of the winter already. They had six of them on a one-day count here just a day or so ago. There is on the DNR website a little information of snowy owl sightings around the state and also a little bit of caution for watching them at a distance and trying to keep them safe because these birds have come a long way. They're oftentimes quite hungry and need to have a little peace and quiet and space so they can hunt successfully and maintain themselves. But it is a spectacular bird to see. It's always a great sight. So some of the big open sweeps of Wisconsin, central Wisconsin, that Stevens Point area, they show up there along Lake Michigan shore, and for others, almost anywhere around the state.
So Becky had also emailed. She was wondering where she could see them. She's near Appleton. So
yeah, I would say check the DNR website. They do have some information there of some of the sightings. And the other place would be eBird. If you have access to that or have that loaded, you might be able to see where bird watchers have recently sighted them. I know that eBird, when we have extremely sensitive species, they don't always post the sightings just so we don't get a mad rush of people that, in a sense, from their enthusiasm, start to harass the bird and perhaps interfere with its ability to feed successfully.
Yeah. Marilyn in Ellison Bay emailed. She's been participating in Project Feeder Watch for several decades. This is the first fall-winter season that's so devoid of birds at her feeders. She lives in a wooded rural area of Door County. She's gone a few weeks in November, but since returning and filling the feeders for 4 weeks, she's missing cardinals, the four species of woodpeckers, goldfinches, blue jays, mourning doves, grosbeaks. Not seeing any of those, even after feeding for 4 weeks, and wonders if you have any thoughts.
Well, I think probably the reason for that is the same reason here. I've got birds at my feeder, but I'm not filling them as fast as I oftentimes do, and I think it's just the lack of snow. The birds are there. They're out there, and as I said, even the finches are coming down. But when we haven't got much snow cover, it's just so easy to find food all over the countryside. They're not forced in for the fast food that we offer. A couple of good storms here. We get not just a good dumping of snow, but it persists for a while. They're going to find that the feeders are quick and easy, and it'll force a lot of birds in. Even juncos, which are a regular visitor at my feeders and all across Wisconsin, they're not here in huge numbers. So in a sense, they don't have to come to the feeders. They're not that desperate for food.
Yeah. And probably the same with Kathy, who had emailed wondering where the goldfinches had gone. She lives in Sturgeon Bay and had at least 30 at her feeders every day for years. The last 2 years, only about 15 a day, and they are house finches, the birds she sees. So probably the same kind of thing.
Right. Much the same thing. But then also for finches, even our goldfinch and house finch, which are summer residents, they tend to be wanderers. So they may move around in wintertime with different food sources. And so just watching your backyard feeder is not always a good indication of what's happening with the population at large.
Jean emailed that she's heard that we should not leave suet out during breeding season, as the birds can get oil on their feet that can plug the pores on eggshells, which will kill the babies inside.
I've never heard of that one before. Yeah, that sounds like a bit of a myth to me. When birds are incubating, they will actually use their breast to apply the heat to the egg. So the female will lose some of the feathers in the undercoat of her breast feathers, so she can get that warmth of her skin right on the eggs. The feet are really off to the side of the egg. They're not standing on them. And sure, eggs have to be somewhat porous for oxygen exchange, but I've never heard them coming back with such big globs of it and standing on the eggs that would do so. I think that is probably a bit of a stretch. So probably the bigger problem for suet in summertime is just that it gets a little runny. I don't think it spoils all that quickly, but it's better as a winter food, I think.
Bill Volkert, our guest today. It's great to have him with us, and we are, well, we're out of emails, so how about emailing us? You can join in with your own questions, maybe your photos as well. Go to ideas@wpr.org and send us an email about a question you have or maybe an experience about a bird that you've been observing or have observed in the past. Ideas@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at bird watching in wintertime with our guest today, Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator and naturalist. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us today. Questions, you can email them. Phones are down, but email us at ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org, or send us a photo as well, and we'd love to see that too. Laura emailed Bill a photo of a red-breasted nuthatch. She saw it for the first time a few years ago. They weren't around last year, but they are back again. I don't know, you can see that photo or not.
Yes, I did. It's very nice. It's a wonderful picture of what I find is to be a really interesting bird. And do we by any chance have the calls of red-breasted and white-breasted nuthatch that we could listen to?
I think we probably do. Tyler, we got a white-breasted and a red-breasted nuthatch. Here's white. Yeah. And here comes the red.
Okay.
So they're different calls, for sure.
Yeah, they're quite similar, or somewhat of easy to confuse, perhaps. But if you notice, the red-breasted nuthatch is a little more, to my ear, more nasal, a little higher call, So there is a distinction between the two. And one of the easier ways to pick them out, especially the red-breasted that loves to hang around in the dense conifer trees. So sometimes a little 4-inch bird like that sitting 30 feet up in a dense spruce can be hard to find, but you can easily hear them up there. And then you can kind of watch to see where he might be. But yeah, they haven't got a real variety of calls or sounds that they make. Just like woodpeckers, they've got a limited vocabulary, but the voices are very distinct.
Yeah, they are. The cadence of the white is a little quicker, I think, than the cadence of the red-breasted. But
maybe. Yeah, they describe it as a yank, yank, or you know, sort of that nasal, and then a little higher, even a little bit more nasal, I would say, for the red-breasted.
Steve emailed, he missed the very beginning of this show, and we played a bird call, a repetitive call that he hears up in the woods. I can't remember which one that was. He missed it at the very beginning of the show.
Oh, what did we play early on?
The pileated we played earlier and the red-breasted.
Yeah, I think it was the pileated woodpecker.
Yeah, the pileated. Have you got that one, Tyler? That's it. Yeah. That's
that loud cackle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there you go, Steve. Peggy in Sheboygan emailed to ask if crossbills are common in winter in southeast Wisconsin.
No, they're not. This is a real nomad, and it's an interesting bird to see because most years they barely even venture into Wisconsin, that northern tier. They're really quite the specialist. They get their name crossbill because their bills actually cross over. So the upper mandible is kind of like a bent scissors tipped over to one side from the other. It looks a little bit like a tin snips. And these are used to pry open the cones of the pines and to extract the seeds. So it's a really specialized tool. So in North America, we have two species, the red crossbill and white winged. And there is a difference between male and female. The females tend to be a little bit more greenish in color. And the white winged, as the name implies, has got white on the wing where the red crossbill is just a deep rosy red color. But yeah, it's a good find. There have been a couple of sightings of them in Wisconsin this year. So a good one to look for.
Pat in Elm Grove just put one of those bird feeders that stick on the window about 25 feet away from our regular feeder, and the birds don't seem to find it at all. Wondering what she should do. So,
yeah, hard to say why they're not coming. I know some of the feeders will hang right on your window, and it's kind of nice to see the birds that up close. Hard to say just what it is. Perhaps the house and window are a little far from any shrubs and shelter that they feel a little reluctant to come out into the open so much. So we like to have our bird feeders somewhat nearby some shelter, some shrubs, a pine or spruce tree, somewhere where the birds can come into, feel safe, make sure the coast is clear, come out for the food, and then head back to. You got to remember, for birds, while our backyards may seem a little tame for us, for birds, it is still the wild, and there's always predators out there. So they want to have some safety. So not just bird food and variety of food that you offer, but you have to have some shelter for them. And I always remind people, this is a good time of year to look at your backyard and think about your spring plantings. What can you add to it? What can you do to make it a little more bird friendly? Middle of winter is not the time to plant anything, but I know some people have taken their old Christmas tree when they're done with it and just stick it out in a snowbank near the feeder. And that'll help for temporary shelter before it all dries up.
All right, let's take another email. Mandy emailed that there used to be a kestrel on the power lines about every mile. She seldom sees one now, wondering about the status of the kestrel.
Kestrel is another bird that is still fairly common in Wisconsin, but from, say, 10, 15 years ago, there has been some decline in it. They are a cavity nester, so they will use a natural cavity or a box, very similar to what, say, a screech owl or a wood duck would use, or just slightly smaller. I know Madison Audubon has erected a number of kestrel boxes. There's been some attempts to provide some of those homes for them as places to nest. Old barns were always good places, but one of the problems is that people have gone from the old wooden barn, which usually had some access into a part of the barn, to the steel buildings, and they tend to be, you know, they hold up longer and they're better sealed. So those are not places for them. And also, our farming these days is a little more clean farming. In other words, we keep the cows inside, where when you used to pasture them and keep them in a yard, there always were not just the waste grain, but because of that, rodents around, which was food for the kestrel. Hard to say just what the cause is. Is it contaminants in the environment? Is it changes in the human landscape that has reduced some of the nesting sites? And I've always said this, that, you know, our first thing to do is to watch birds, conduct good scientifically sound surveys, and see what the status is. If we see that birds are declining, now that's the much harder question, is what's the cause and what can we do about it? And for a lot of birds these days, it's not just a single cause and effect. It seems to be in multiple factors, and that makes it hard to really unravel the puzzle and to do something effectively. But we're watching all the birds we can. We're trying to help all those that are showing some decline, and we're trying to give them a place in this human-dominated world so that we can keep that nice variety of birds around. But some places it becomes more challenging than others.
Yeah. Pam from Irma emailed, they have had a part albino chickadee at their feeder for about a month. She looked it up. It's called the leucistic variation. How common are they in north central Wisconsin? It's very skittish, hard to get a picture of compared to regular chickadees.
He may be a little more skittish because he knows he stands out a bit. Perhaps that's keeping him a little shy because he's the odd one in the crowd. Leucistic is really referred to sometimes as partial albinism. So in other words, they're not pure white, pink eyes, pink feet. In other words, a total lack of pigments. But the lack of pigments may show up in certain body parts. I've seen it with just a few tail feathers or wing feather or part of the body. And it can show up in almost any bird species. So it's really just the roll of the dice. It is a mutation. And, you know, birds, especially where you've got those that are quite common in large numbers, such as robins, blackbirds, Canada geese, these odd plumages tend to show up a little more frequently, but it can show up in most any of them. Yeah, it's sometimes even throws the bird watcher when you're looking at white in a bird that's not supposed to be there and you're trying to figure out what it is.
Oh, man. Here's an interesting experience. A listener emailed, last summer there was an owl that swooped down at him while he was trying to look at it, wondering, was it aggressive or just an accident? Wonder what kind of cap he had.
Yeah, my guess would be it was during summertime. Perhaps there was a nest nearby or a young that had recently fledged that it's just trying to keep them out of the area that felt as if those were a little vulnerable. That's usually where owls will swoop down at people as you're getting near a nest site. And of course, if you've got an active hawk or owl nest, some of them can be incredibly aggressive in order to protect it. So yeah, you've got to watch a little bit. Something I've done a few times for owls, where I've known they've roost during the day in pine plantations, I'll walk very quietly if the ground isn't crunching or if there's a little snow cover. And during the day, I make really high little mouse squeaks, kind of just suck a little air through your lips so you get a really high little squeak. And you have to be very loud with it. I've had them actually just appear and just stare at me. And on one occasion, I had a long-eared owl that swooped back and forth over my head wondering where this mouse was.
So, oh man,
messing with the owls a little bit.
Oh man. Well, here's one from Dick who emailed. He had an Oregon race junco at the feeder this fall, wondering how common they are in Wisconsin.
Well, that's again one of those wanderers. The Oregon population is in that far northwest part of the continent. And it is distinguished by having the black head and a brown body, where ours in the past was called slate-colored junco. They're overall just that slate gray. It's part of a Western population. And juncos, this is a group of birds that the biologists have had a hard time kind of slicing and dicing because there's a lot of variation among them across the continent. Ours are that slate color, all grayish above, a little bit of a cutoff line across the chest, white underneath, and then white outer tail feathers. In the Dakotas, they've got white in the wing. And then as you go further to the west, you've got the black head and the brown body. And at one point, we actually considered all of these distinct species, but we find that the genetics, they're pretty closely related. These are just variations in the expression of the plumage, the colors. So we lumped them all together. They're the dark-eyed junco, and we could just consider them subspecies. But yeah, these are regional populations, and yeah, you might get, especially that Oregon one coming into Wisconsin. So yeah, watch them a little bit. You might see a little variation among the individuals.
Yeah, very, very cool. Bill Volkert, our guest today, retired wildlife educator and naturalist, worked at Horican Marsh for 27 years, and he's been watching birds for a long, long time. He sighted more than 3,900 species of birds. That's amazing. He's going to be with us right up till 12:30, and you'll have a chance to send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. I'd love to hear from you. And Bill's, as you've heard, he's quick with a great answer. So I hope you'll do that, and I hope you'll stay with us with the look at the news, and then we'll be back with Bill. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking birds with birding expert Bill Volkert today. Bill, a retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist. Great to have him with us. Questions about a bird you've seen, maybe you have a bird feeder question, send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And send us your photos as well. We love to see them. Kathy emailed a nice picture of a brown thrasher coming to feed under their sunflower and feeders there from November 23rd until December 21st. They're just south of Fifield, which is south of Park Falls. And they, of course, they hope it makes it south soon.
Yeah, he's a bit of a straggler as well. It's a bird that shows up fairly early in spring. It's not a real long-distance migrant. Most of them will stay in the southern U.S. And on occasion, one or two will try to linger at least into the early part of winter. I also want to acknowledge some of the other pictures that people have sent. Jill's been nice enough to forward those. Yeah, we've got about three or four pileated woodpecker pictures. Very nice.
Yes. And Snowy Lisa owl sent and a picture woodpecker. Of a...
Great.
Lisa sent a picture of a barred owl, thrilled many people in the neighborhood between Thanksgiving and last week when she saw crows coming after it. She witnessed the bird swoop over the pond and scoop up a frog. That's a beautiful picture.
That's an unusual food source for him. Yeah.
Beautiful, beautiful photo.
And barred owl is not that uncommon in Wisconsin, but like any owl, it's secretive. And she mentioned the owls or the crows were harassing it. Crows reserve a very special call for any owls that they see. They're enemies. The crows will harass the heck out of sometimes the hawks and especially owls during the day. And at nighttime, the owls will come out and they'll try to hunt the crows off their roost site. But they've got, if you hear a really deep, raucous screeching of crows, and then watch to see one or two of them perched and perhaps others swooping back and forth. It's called the mobbing behavior, and that's just what they're doing. They're trying to get together. I refer to it as calling all crows. They get everybody in the neighborhood there and in just numbers. They don't want to get too close, but they try to just become such a bother that they drive the owl out of the neighborhood and hopefully then get them far enough away so they can get a night's sleep. One of the best ways to find owls, really, is to wait for the crows to find them.
I love the photo that Ruth emailed. She had a photo of her hand feeding that downy woodpecker at Rose Lake. What other birds besides chickadees can be fed with a bit of patience from the hand?
Well, probably most feeder birds, if you spend enough time. I remember a fellow years ago had this great picture. He was standing in his backyard with a straw hat on. And he had blackbirds that were sitting on his shoulder and on his head. And he revealed to me a secret. He said what he did is he put the straw hat out next to the feeder and he filled the whole brim of it full of sunflower seeds, let him come in for a couple of days, and then he stood out there and put the hat on his head. So, yeah, you could habituate birds to feeding out of the hand, but remember that they're always going to be quite cautious. They're going to be a little bit shy. But with some patience, the chickadees are probably one of the friendliest, so to speak, birds that will approach very close. In fact, my chickadees, I've actually had them land on the feeder real briefly just while I'm filling it. They'll come in. They don't mind I'm standing right there, but they'll come in, perch, fly off about 10 feet, and just wait for me to move back a bit. Probably one of the more friendly and accommodating of birds.
Yeah. John emailed a picture taken in Nina this summer. It was taken when there were large wildfires just to the west. Sunset was reflecting on the white breast, giving it a red glow. He thinks it's a northern harrier. The bird hung around for several days. He's wondering why he hasn't heard anything about Horican Marsh in the discussion of observing cranes this fall. He just moved back to Wisconsin in April and remembered in years before going there and seeing them by the hundreds in the fall.
It is a place for cranes to stage, and some of the big marshes in Wisconsin are probably some of the better places to see them, in particularly October, November. So cranes are pretty solitary, nesting all across Wisconsin in the Midwest. And as we get into late summer, they start to flock up, and then you'll see them get together what we call staging areas. These are places where the flocks start to really grow. They'll fly out in the morning to feed nearby and then come back to these large roost sites. It's not that Horicon is a place where the cranes have abandoned it, but it's perhaps just something that hasn't been in the news or talked about recently. By the way, I also see the hawk picture here with the, it looks like that reddish, this is a red-tail hawk.
Red-tail
hawk, I've got a different
yes.
picture. Yeah, unless that's a different picture, but with that speckling across the center of the breast, that's red-tail.
And Mandy in River Falls emailed, she had called earlier about the mushrooms in the birdhouse.
And I see the picture, yes. That's quite the harvest.
It's quite a harvest of mushrooms. Oh, my goodness me. Wow. Well, we've got some more emails.
So, like I mentioned, probably some rodents that's been caching them.
Yeah. Larry emailed, they heard a whippoorwill this summer on their farm in Alma in Buffalo County. It was the first time in many years. In the past, they'd hear them all the time. He wonders about why they went away, and does this one, hearing this one summer, signal a return? The whippoorwill, and I haven't heard one in a long time either.
Yeah, we've talked about this back in spring, I believe. Yeah, that's a bird that has shown some pretty significant declines. The last stronghold of them is southwest and west central Wisconsin. They're not in big numbers, but that's one of the few places you can still hear them. And typical of bird populations, as they start to decline, what we see is the population sort of shrinks to its core area. In other words, that was always the best habitat, and then smaller numbers were scattered throughout a lot of the woodlands in Wisconsin. But as we've seen a decline in the population, that's kind of the last stronghold. One individual is not really, say, a return of the population. Could have been a successful young, a straggler, or pioneer. They're at least hanging on. I don't know if it's been declining much further in the past few years, but it is worrisome, and we're not sure what the cause is. We're really not certain what's leading to that. But it is a bird that needs large insects. When we know that insect populations have been declining, there may be contaminants in the food, and they migrate all the way to the tropics. So they've got a lot of challenges.
Yeah, they do. I don't know if Tyler, have you got a whippoorwill for us? He may or may not have a whippoorwill.
Well named after its call.
He'll have one coming up. I'm pretty sure he says he'll have one coming up pretty quickly.
Okay.
Betsy in South Milwaukee emailed, they have an evening grosbeak at their feeder who is banded. Where do they go find the information? Yeah, where do they go to find information on where it was banded? It's a silver band with two rows of three numbers.
Yes. These are the typical leg bands that are placed on songbirds. The only way to know for sure is you'd have to be able to read the entire sequence of numbers. And you're usually going to have three or four numbers in the prefix and then five numbers following that. So it's a big series of numbers, and it's written more or less right around half the band. I've been a bird bander for almost 40 years now. And it is interesting. It gives us a research data that we can't get in other ways. But yeah, the only way to really get information, you have to have that bird where you can read it. And it's usually another bander has to recapture the bird and read that number. But it's the Bird Banding Laboratory of the U.S. Geological Survey that keeps that whole database. And there's almost, gosh, 50 million records or so of them.
And I think we've got a whippoorwill from Tyler. Eastern whippoorwill. Kind of says its own name, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's obvious where he got his name from. It's a spectacular call, and they can be incredibly vocal and just go on for the longest time. And unfortunately for so many of us, it's a sound that has been disappearing across a lot of the woods in Wisconsin, so we just don't hear it as frequently. And certainly something that we miss in a lot of areas.
Ezra emailed, he's seen a large number of red-breasted nuthatches at his feeders. They seem to be taking black sunflower seeds to the ground, burying them quickly and returning to the feeder. Seems they're doing this too quickly to be eating the seed. Is this normal behavior?
Nuthatches will do that. Well, I've seen red, white-breasted nuthatches commonly take a single seed, fly off, and they'll wedge it into the bark of a tree. Sometimes they'll hold it there because they can't hold it with their feet and use it to pry it open then. So it's sort of pinned against the bark, or sometimes they cache them. And this is a typical behavior, you know, waiting for bad weather, put a little bit of food here and there in case the snow covers up the food supply. They just haven't figured out that I fill the feeder every day anyway. So it doesn't matter where they put those seeds, they'll always be available. But yeah, it's an instinctive behavior. They may just be caching the food rather than actually consuming it at that time.
I'm not sure if we talked about kestrels before, but Mandy had emailed about kestrels on power lines. About every mile she'd see them, seldom sees them.
Yes, we talked
now
about that earlier.
Yeah,
that,
we did
talk
about that.
There has been some
that
decline. Yep.
Yeah, Greg emailed that in 1982. He was in the Estes, Colorado area in the Rocky Mountain National Park near the Poudre River. They saw many large gray jay-like or even smallish crow-shaped birds in and around the rocks and boulders. Their guide said they were Clark's jays. And Greg's never
Clark's
been able to
nutcracker
find Clark's nutcracker. He couldn't find Clark's jay.
Yeah, there is a gray jay, which also occurs in the Rocky Mountains as well as in Canada. We talked about earlier in the program, a little holdout in a few places in northern Wisconsin. And then in the west, the Clark's nutcracker. These are all in that jay crow family. But yeah, that's a bird you'll have to go out west to find.
Kathy in Ocano says, if the hundreds of sandhills that congregate at the Ocano Marsh to roost in October or November head south to their winning grounds when they leave, or just head to more southerly staging area in Wisconsin, like the lower Wisconsin River, the one there?
They'll go a little farther than that. Occasionally, we may see a crane lingering in Wisconsin in wintertime, but it'd have to have a pretty good lack of snow for a long period. Most of them are heading south to at least Tennessee, southern Illinois. So they're getting beyond the snow line. The traditional winter area for those birds that go all the way south would be from southern Georgia to northern Florida. So around that Ocala and Okefenokee area. And then anywhere in between, south of the snow line. That's really the main migration for the eastern sandhill crane.
Lyman and McFarland emailed that several years ago. He had a clear look at a bird that looked exactly like a blue jay, hopped between branches just like a jay, but it was totally black. Scruffy feathers, spiky feathers on the head. Strangest bird sighting ever. Does the blue jay have such a freak variant?
Well, black would be the opposite of albinism. It's the melanism. It's overproduction of pigments rather than a lack. It's not real common in birds. Now, there is a possibility, and we have had a few records of birds coming into the central part of the U.S., and this is the western counterpart, the Steller's jay. So our blue jay is fairly common here in the eastern U.S., and as you get out, say, from the edge of the Rockies and west from there, there is a jay. The Steller's has a black head with a bluish body, a little deeper blue than the blue jay. And on the adults, two white eyebrows, stripes right across the upper part of the head. It's a fascinating looking bird.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
So maybe a straggler of the Steller's jay, I'd say more likely than all black plumage.
Brian emailed that there are lots of references to seagull in popular cultures, but his bird book shows over 20 gulls and no subgroup or species is listed as a seagull. Is there such a thing as a seagull?
Oh, good question. Seagull is sort of the generic name for the gulls. And we talked earlier about how hard it can be to separate bald eagle from golden eagle. Well, the gulls, there are some that will have a two-year plumage, so an immature winter plumage, and an adult plumage. Others, like the herring gull, may take 4 years to acquire the adult plumage. And in Wisconsin, herring gull, ringbill gull, and Bonaparte's gull are our most common. But yeah, there are species all over the world. And with the variations, they can be hard to sort out. The avid bird watchers, they'll spend their time at two places, Long Lake, Michigan, looking for Iceland gull, glaucous gull, lesser blackback gulls that may mix in. And so you'll see people with their scopes going back and forth through these huge flocks of gulls looking for the one oddball in there that's mingled with it. By the way, another place that birders go to over by Johnson Creek, there's a big landfill site there that attracts a lot of scavenging gulls, and they're finding some odd ones that are mixed in there. So yeah, seagull is a generic term for people who kind of brush them off. They're all just gulls. But the bird watchers, yes, there is no seagull. They are all members of the gull family and a lot of different species with many plumage variations.
Ken emailed to ask, what do you think about the presence of a remnant population of the ivory-billed woodpecker? Cornell University ornithologist had a blurred photo of this species in a remote swamp of Arkansas. That goes back a few years. Also, Hill from Auburn University said he's heard the calls of this bird and found larger holes in trees that were not from pileated woodpeckers. This location was in the panhandle of Florida. There have been multiple recent searches without any published reports.
This may be wishful thinking. The ivory-billed woodpecker was at one time the biggest woodpecker in the world. It was a larger cousin of our pileated. It was especially in the southern swamps coming up the lowlands of the Mississippi River and across the southern part of the United States into the southeast. But with the intensive logging that took place in the cypress swamps, there was destruction of the habitat, and the bird population started to decline very quickly. Yeah, in about 2002, I think it was, there was a report of a bird in the Cache River bottoms in far southern Illinois. There were searches that went on for quite a while. They had parties of volunteers going out to look through all over these backwaters. They also put out recording instruments, because they have a very unique, what they call a double tap. And actually, if you get into the tropics of Central and South America, there are relatives to the pileated and to the ivory-billed. And pileated is in this genus of birds called dendrocops, and the ivory-billed is related to this Campocephalus. And you'll hear the double knock. It's very distinct, always two taps. Now, they've never been able to confirm the double tap of this bird anywhere the ivory billed was located, and actual clear evidence. They've never been able to confirm this possible sighting in 2002. The general rule is if a bird has never been sighted or confirmed again to exist in the wild after 50 years, we then consider it extinct. Yep. we're holding out all hope. Maybe it's not, but it does not seem likely that any of those exist anymore. It would be a surprise to the world if it could find one, but this is the sad thing for us to keep in mind. We have lost birds. We are continuing to see bird populations decline. There are roughly 10,000 kinds of birds all over this world. They inhabit all kinds of corners, and we need good conservation everywhere they live if we're ever going to keep this richness of nature around there so that we can all at least be joyful that they still exist, much less the chance for us to see and explore them.
And I think Tyler may have a recording of an ivory bill from a long time ago. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's, you can hear the hiss from the recording. That's an old, old recording, but it's,
I was just going to point that out. Yeah, that's a historical recording, and unfortunately, that's all we've got of them. And so, you know, we also lose those voices in nature. And, you know, it would be such a shame.
It's a pretty cool voice.
Yeah, to have any of these birds disappear. So, yeah, enjoy them and discover them, and let's also work to keep them there.
Well, fortunately, I can see one anytime I want because I have a wood carving from a pretty famous wood carver of an ivory-billed woodpecker. And it's
and unfortunately, it's just this effigy or image of one. Perhaps the real one does not even exist anymore.
Yeah.
A sad note.
A sad note indeed. Mike and Mercer had red-legged partridge all summer, but it's gone now. He's never seen them before, red-legged partridge.
The Partridge Family, and I don't mean the musical group, this is the Hungarian partridge and chukar partridge, as the name implies for Hungarian. It is an import. They were brought here for a game farm, and there were some attempted releases. Hungarian partridge did exist in Wisconsin for a while. They seem to have declined and all but disappeared with changes in agricultural land use practices. And in the foothills of the Rockies, the chukar partridge was released there and, again, kept as a game bird. There's occasionally an escapee out there. So that would be my guess that you probably had something that escaped from a game farm somewhere.
Yeah, we see that pretty often. Well, Bill, I don't know how many calls, questions we answered today, but it was probably a record because we had a lot of emails. I want to thank you so much for being with us today. As we Christmas a couple days off, it's great to have you for the holidays, and I'm looking forward to our next visit. Thanks a lot, Bill.
You're very welcome. Thanks so much for having me, and I hope people continue to watch birds and enjoy them.
Bill Volkert, our guest, he will be back and be with us again, a retired wildlife educator and naturalist, worked at Horican Marsh for 27 years. Thanks for all the great emails and photos. It was really a lot of fun for me today and for Bill, I'm sure, and I hope it was fun for you as well. And Santa joins us from the North Pole, and kids, hopefully we'll have our phone lines up and kids will be able to call in and talk to Santa Claus tomorrow on this program from 11 to 12:30. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mehler.